It is said that the poet Sappho invented the lesbian sometime between 620 and 570 BCE. Men had been screwing each other for a while by then. We know this is true because it had been written about by men, sung about by men, and encouraged by women repulsed by men.
Thus begins a short history of queer women, the witty romp through LGBTQ+ history written by our guest today, Kirsty Lohr. We are honored and privileged, the royal we, to get to speak to Kirsty today. I am personally extremely excited to speak to someone who has been writing queer history with a goddamn sense of humor. When I first came across this little tome, I was actually in Shakespeare & Co. in Paris, brag. It was raining outside, I'd had two glasses of wine at lunch, and the books were just staring at me in that slutty way, saying, do it, come on, just buy me. I was thrilled to see a kindred spirit like Kirsty had gotten a book published, a book that makes queer history more accessible and entertaining as the gay gods intended. Selfishly, my heterosexual sister then rushed me out of the store before I could invest in Kirsty's book. And so I didn't finish reading it until a few months ago. But as soon as I did, I knew I had to speak to the woman behind this delightful tour through the most lesbianic history of womankind, however you define that word. So, get out your impermeable overalls and your butchiest boots, because the water is about to get what, Kirsty?
Human temperature.
So let's go back in time and take another rewrite through our history. Celebrate ourselves tonight and cover all the things that still a mystery.
Kirsty, welcome to the pod. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
So, Kirsty, I want to start learning a little bit about you before we get into your work. So who are you? What do you do? What are you passionate about?
So I'm Kirsty Lohr. I'm from Manchester in the UK. I love football, which is a big thing if you live in Manchester. But I don't live in Manchester anymore. I actually live in Brighton, which is known as the queer capital of the UK.
Yes.
Yes. I don't know, living both in Manchester, which is also very queer, and Brighton, they're both very different, really, with being queer. But I probably would say Brighton is the number one.
I've been to Brighton Pride before.
Oh, yeah? I love Brighton Pride.
Yes, I went with a lover for a weekend in Brighton.
How romantic.
Yeah. And I mean, it was actually kind of romantic. And it was very cute because all of the old gays were out in the parade. And I was just like, oh, this is what it's like to be in a gay village, you know?
Yeah. But it is very much that vibe. Yeah.
What do you do? What are you passionate about? I know you're a teacher.
Yeah. So I teach English, but as a language. So I teach mainly to adults from all over the world.
Fantastic.
So I've been doing that for like 12 years. And I write a lot of materials. I do a lot of exams with students that want to get into university. That's how I make my money, really. And then I write. So I wrote that book, A Short History of Queer Women. And
famously.
That famous worldwide author, Kirsty Lohr. I just write bits and bobs that I can. But teaching is like the bread and butter, pretty much.
Cool. Okay, interesting. So how did you start writing about history? When did you fall in love with history? When did you fall in love with queer history?
I love history. I've always loved history. My mom loves history. She's a big history buff. But I think being a queer kid in a place where I wasn't comfortable coming out. So I was about maybe 15, 16 when I realized that something was up. And I used history, mainly film history, because I was really interested in film. So film history, the classical Hollywood, you know, like the 30s and 40s and Clark Gable, Marilyn Monroe, all of that. It was this form of escapism for me. So I just sit in the library and just read about film history. And a lot of those people were queer, and yep. it was very coded. And I don't know, I just gravitated towards that, I think, because maybe that's how I felt. So it was something that I really gravitated towards, and it's become a passion of mine, is film history, but particularly just history in general, really. I love it. I just love it. I get upset sometimes that I can't travel through time. It like genuinely breaks my heart that I can't go back in time. I just get really upset.
I know. I used to have, and I've often thought about how history, to me, history is like so much more imaginative than people give it credit for. You know, it actually takes a lot of creativity to put yourself there, to think about it, to picture it, and not let it just be an assemblage of facts and figures. So I felt that reading your book. I felt that you were really interpreting queer history and bringing it into the present moment. What spurred this book? Where did this book come from? How did the idea pop into your head?
Well, there was two reasons. The one reason was, as a kid, like I say, I loved history. And I just felt like it was not boring, but I mean, it's just, I don't know what it's like in the States, but in the UK, it's World War One and Two is what you study at school. That was it, basically. Just that it. Anything that made Britain look good was what we would study. So,
sure.
Yeah, and the books were also very inaccessible, and like academia in general, and then once I got older, I got interested in queer theory and gender studies and lesbian studies, and again, it was just, it's very academic, isn't it? Really academic. Yes. And when you're interested in that, it can be quite inaccessible, and it, a lot of the time I would struggle to really wrap my head around it. I remember reading Judith Butler and knowing that I was interested in this, but not quite really understanding what on earth she was talking about. Still today, really. So that was something that I really wanted to change. I just thought, I want to write a book in my own voice with humor as well, because you know, queer theory and queer history isn't generally funny. It's quite dark and sad, and there's a lot of death. But, you know, it's like queer people are also funny, and they also had nice parts of their lives that weren't all about death. So humour was another part of something that I wanted to include in history, because people are funny now and they were funny in the past. And another thing was, because I love history, it's chronological, isn't it? History, well, a heteronormative history is chronological. And as a queer person, I never quite had that. It was just trying to fit things together from there, or a love note from there, or I don't right. know, maybe like...
It's sort of scattered. Bits.
Yeah, it's disparate. Like wedged. Yeah, it's all like knitted together, isn't it? And just all kind of fragments of here and there. So I selfishly wanted to just write a chronological timeline of queer history for me, because I like history and it was for me. So yeah, two reasons.
That's the best reason, doing it for yourself. I'm just like giddy listening to you though, because I feel so much of the same things. I got a master's in classics. And so I spent 5 years in higher education, and I majored in history in my undergraduate degree. I didn't know shit about anything to do with queer history throughout that entire brief academic career. But, you know, still pretty, I learned a lot and did a lot of shit and wrote a lot of papers, and I just didn't come across it at all. It was after I left university, when I continued reading at that academic level, that I started to come across these books. And I thought the exact same thing. I was like, why is all this gold trapped in these dusty ass books that no one is going to read? No one can understand this shit. Like, and I find the other annoying thing about academics is that they are nuance queens, you know, not size queens, but nuance queens. They just can't get over all the qualifications and all of the, so it was very refreshing going through your book and just not having to deal with any of that. Just referring to people as lesbians. Of course, I want to talk about some of the maybe issues that you ran into in the process of writing history in that way. But I think it's incredibly liberating for us when we've not been able to see ourselves in history to throw that academic red tape to the wind and just claim some of them for our community, you know? And it's my whole thing with historical homos is that it's not just like there's some random ass people who might have been gay in the past. Some of the most important people in the world were gay, were queer, were transgender. So that story has to be told as well, you know? And I noticed that in your book as well, that you combined both stories of more forgotten names with the more exalted, the Virginia Woolfs of the queer canon. So I think that's really important too. All right, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but I do have two very important questions before we get into our first act talking more about history. Obviously, I need to know, which long dead lesbians, famous or not, you have the hots for?
I just have the hots for all of them. Like, this is my problem in life, though. Like, I just fancy everyone. Like, I honestly do. Like, any woman, I just fall in love with immediately. I just find women really fucking hot and sexy, and especially women like who have just, like, intelligence is a big thing for me. And a lot of these women in these books are just so super smart and so super intelligent. So yes. Yeah, all of them. But I mean, I've always been obsessed with Virginia Woolf. This is someone that, not really for the, I mean, I love her writing, obviously, but the writing sometimes is a bit much for me.
I know. Have you gotten through The Waves ever?
No, I tried and I couldn't. And I'm not trying anymore. No, I mean, I also find it really funny that I've like written one book and I just keep saying that Virginia Woolf is just a bit much. Like, she's the best, one of the best writers in the world, and I'm just like, meh. But I do, Orlando is one of my favorite books. But her as a person, I just think she's fascinating. Just her brain and the way she works and the way she talks and how confident she was, but then how like awful she was to herself as well, and just these different parts of her personality, which were just so human, and how she was so open to having a relationship with a woman and a man, and how she forged a relationship with her husband, which was not romantic, but there was a lot of love between them.
Yes.
And then there was a very romantic relationship with Vita Sackville-West. So yeah, just all of that. And even the way that she committed suicide was just so like dramatic and...
I think about it.
Her pockets.
That might be my Roman Empire.
Like, I was going to say, is that your Roman Empire?
I think about it way too often.
So do I. I live right near the river as well.
Yeah, I'm near a river right now. It's just like, first of all, the drama of that. Second of all, like, there's something kind of very DIY about it, of just like, oh, just use these little rocks that I have laying around, which is both cute and freaks me out at the same time. And then just also imagining like being found in a river. Like, I can't, that image.
Okay.
Okay, we're getting morbid.
I myself am strange and unusual.
But that,
yeah,
it is fascinating. I also, speaking of humor, Virginia Woolf was fucking funny.
So funny.
She is a cutting bitch.
She's a bitch.
She is so mean. I love it.
I just spent a year once reading her diaries, and I was quite depressed at the time. And I think I went on antidepressants after I read the whole diary. But I started to think I was her, and then I started like behaving like her. And I remember when she was getting with Vita Sackville-West, like she was like, "Oh, you're so beautiful, but like you're writing shit."
Yeah.
So she just slated her writing constantly. And was like, just "You are not a good writer."
Yeah.
But yeah, she was very funny.
Let's keep Virginia in the back of our minds, because I think we're going to need her again when we come to a later segment. Okay, you also said you love time travel. So
yes.
You have to pick a time period. You have one day to live as a gay in any time period. What's it going to be?
Victorian times.
Whoa. Okay, rogue.
Yeah, is it? Is that right?
You want it when it's most oppressed?
Well, that's what people always think. But those guys were just so sexually perverse. They loved it. It was just kept under. Sure. It was just such bullshit. Like, they all were like, "We're prudes. We don't have sex." But they went at it. All of them did. I think I like the Victorian times because people were forming identities. They had done so before, but the sexologists were apparent then. And I really like the idea of those underground bars, that idea of secrecy and meeting people that were like you. And I mean, for them, obviously, that wasn't nice. I'm glamorizing that a bit. But just that idea of just going into this little underground speakeasy and suddenly you realize that all the men in there that are dressed in male clothes are all women. That is something that I would love to have experienced.
I wonder about this all the time, because in writing and reading about queer history, I think the question often occurs, at least to me, I don't know if you experience this, but the question often occurs, what have we lost in making all of the gains that we have, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes that feels like a very ungrateful question to be asking, because I'm happy to be able to be open and all of that. But it does feel like there's a little bit of something special, something glamorous, something boundary breaking that doesn't get to exist in the same way as it used to.
Yeah.
And also not just people in the Victorian era, but people in the Edwardian era and you know, maybe the 20s as well. I don't know if that still counts as Edwardian, but I feel that they weren't as obsessed with labels, and they were interested in labels, and labels were becoming a new thing, but it wasn't as sort of like, I am this and this means that about me forever.
Mm.
And I think that freedom and fluidity is something that also we might have lost a little bit. I mean, it seems to be coming back now.
Yeah,
in terms of how people identify but at the same time, there's a lot of dogma around those conversations, a lot of doctrine, you know, there's a lot of rules, and I'm not sure those rules existed in quite the same way.
No, and I think I tend to look at it as the time that we live in now isn't great, because we have all these legal rights, and because I get this question, I get people asking me this a lot, like, where would you go if you went back in time? And I'm just thinking, you're comparing that to now as if it's fine now, but it's
right.
It's really not. You know, trans people are being killed every single day of the year just for being themselves. Queer people, lesbians, gay people, bisexual people, we're still being persecuted. And this is, I'm talking Western here, not even in the rest of the world. And yes, there are legal rights now, which I am very grateful for, because I have a son and he is my son and I am his mother and his birth certificate. But yeah, it's just that otherness is still there. But with the magic that you talked about, I do feel that a little bit still with the community. I do still feel like I'm part of something really cool. And these straight people, these heterosexual people, these people that follow a heteronormative lifestyle are really missing out on how cool that is. Like, I do genuinely feel
they're trying
really sorry
to get in on it. They are trying to get in on it.
They are. And I feel really sorry for them, because they're really boring. They're just so boring.
It's so, so sad to be straight.
It is.
I agree. Okay, so let's get into talking about writing the book.
Yeah.
Act 1, Doing Queer Women and Their History. So I frequently feel like people don't understand how difficult it is to access a lot of this history, for a lot of reasons, because it's typically written about in academic monographs and complicated books and the Judith Butlers of the world, yada, yada, yada. But in the case of the history of queer women, I think it's also it's just hard to access the history of women in the first place.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Women are just not in the picture for a lot of history. I studied ancient history, so I've felt, and you know, as a like any card-carrying gay, I fundamentally find women more interesting than men, except sexually. But like women are absent from ancient history, which is devastating. So how did you deal with this, and how did it feel? I mean, most of our sources are men talking about women, queer women. How did you work through that or around it?
Well, yeah, women are always a supporting act, aren't they? But I mean, when you say how do I feel, I'm used to it. You know, when you grow up and you're born as a woman and you live this world as a woman, you're used to it. So that's just how it is, really. But what did I do? I laugh and joke about how I just invented most of it. These people existed. Of course they existed. There's no way they didn't. So, and a lot of historians, male historians, will invent will fill in the gaps with their own ideas based on something that they have seen, but they will fill in the gaps. Straight, being heterosexual is always the default. And I really hung on to that, in that it's always a default that they would be heterosexual. So why not just flip that? Why not the default just be that they were queer? And why am I not allowed to do that? If historians do that, why can't I do that? Why can't I say, well, you know, maybe they were queer. They were queer because maybe this, or maybe there's no evidence. Like with Emily Bronte, for example, there's no romantic evidence at all that she was into men or women. Actually, it's likely she would have been asexual. But there was a film recently about her and a man that used to visit the parsonage, and they just invented this relationship that was based on no truth whatsoever. So if people can do that in films and invent the truth for people that are as famous as Emily Bronte, then why can't I do it? So I would fixate on people and I would read it in a queer way. And that's why we're blessed with this word queer, aren't we? And queer reading and looking at things through a different lens. And once you start looking at things through a different lens, it all just jumps out at you. And I found that initially with film history, as I said at the beginning. Once you look at all these film stars and these movies and how they were coded and things like that, they all just jump out at you. No pun intended, but they just come out. Once you look at it a different way, they just come out to you. So you just have to challenge. Let the clues come out. Yeah, you just got to change that way of thinking. And it just becomes very easy.
But to be fair, in the book, first of all, in the book, you take us through the history of queer womankind from the beginning to the end, right? Up to the present day. Beginning with Sappho, who is that sort of OG lesbian quintessential first starting point for a lot of people doing the history of queer women. It's not like you're making everything up about Sappho. Like,
no,
you know,
no.
You are making some assumptions and inferences, but I think, like you said, we have a right to make those assumptions and inferences. And actually, I would argue that you have the right to make them even more so in the ancient world than you do maybe about someone like Emily Bronte. I mean, Emily Bronte is living in a time when the norm is heterosexuality. That's the expectation. So statistically, it's going to be more, you know, visible and present. That's not necessarily the full case in the ancient world where they had a completely different attitude to sex and sexuality. Yeah. They didn't think about sexuality as something that one has or is, right? So queer behavior can be detected in lots of different places. One of the things that I find in doing this history, and I think we're both people who probably gravitate more towards writing as our way of expressing ourselves or you know, creating our output, but I find looking at the imagery of the past really helps as well. There are oil lamps from Pompeii where women are fucking each other.
Yeah.
There are paintings from brothels where women are fucking each other. Like, there's graffiti. I think you have graffiti in the book, right?
Yeah. From Pompeii, yeah.
From Pompeii. So this stuff isn't like, and then my favorite thing is with the graffiti in Pompeii is when the academics are like, but this was probably just a man assuming the poetic persona of a woman because women can't do this, can't write. Blah. And it's just like, dude, how many circles are you going to make us jump through? But I think that is also a really powerful part of the historical record that people also don't get to access, and seeing is believing, right? It's not just in these poems or academic monographs. Like, there is physical, visual evidence out there that queer people have been around forever. So I find that's also a really helpful motivator, right? In doing this history, is actually like seeing it and not just being forced to work with like the dusty words and textbooks and stuff like that.
Yeah, and you're right as well. There is a lot of visual. There's the famous statue of the two Egyptian women that's been going the rounds on the internet at the moment in social media, where they say historians will say they're just friends, whereas these two women, these Egyptian women, a statue was made of the two of them, which was very something that would really happen back then. And they were made together, so it was likely that they were in a relationship. I think not just Christianity, but religion as a whole was one of the main factors of kind of before Christianity and took hold of most of Europe.
Ruining everything.
Sexuality was a lot more freeing. And I mean, look at the Romans, for example. They were all at it with each other. Yeah. It was a very normal part of culture was having that, having same-sex relationships, men and women. Men we mostly know about, but women too. And ancient Greece and things like that. It was very, very common. But right. I think a lot of that history has been erased due to religion. And a lot of things that we will never get to see that have probably been destroyed. So religion was a big part of changing that whole narrative. But also you do find the references in religious scripts. So clearly there was something going on for them to comment on it and say, no, you cannot do that.
Right, so, exactly.
Yeah, so there clearly things were happening.
Yeah, I just did an episode with a friend of mine who is a Jewish educator and a comedian on ancient Jewish lesbians, because lesbians are not really very prominent in the Jewish texts. And so we were talking about Ruth and Naomi in the Bible,
which is iffy.
Like, it doesn't feel full les. But then you get a few centuries later and there are Talmudic scholars writing about mesolelot, which is this ancient Hebrew word for chicks getting it on together. And they're, of course, writing about how dangerous it is and how we have to keep our wives away from this. God forbid they figure out that there's a better option out there. And you're like, oh, well, this was obviously big enough to be a problem to be writing about it. Like,
exactly, yeah.
You don't just write about anything when you are when you're writing in the ancient world, right?
No, you don't just suddenly go, we should maybe just say something. Something clearly has inspired that.
Yeah. So, okay, here's another side of this that I think is interesting and something that I run into a lot. But how did you decide whom to include in your narrative? Because like I said, you include a lot of people from different backgrounds, from different geographies, a lot of people, and you're also doing, you know, a sort of trans historical narrative.
Yeah.
So who counts as a queer woman? How did you make that decision?
Yeah, it was difficult. One thing that I really wanted to do with queer history and women in particular was the queer people that you do find are often white and Western males with a higher class because they were either literate, they were able to write about themselves, or they had someone who was able to write about them. There was some importance to them. That's why we know about them. And I really wanted to find those people that weren't so much, especially people of color. With the countries and looking at it from a Western perspective, that was more difficult because I need to acknowledge, I guess, my own privilege and that I can't be looking at other cultures and identities with kind of the way how I look at sexuality. So that was quite difficult for me to look at somewhere like, I don't know, Indonesia and be like, where are the lesbians? This person's a lesbian. Or, you know, like Two Spirits and Native Americans and things like that. That was tricky. And I, as much as I wanted to include all over the world, which I did try to, I was very choosy about who I included because I didn't want to offend people. So if the evidence was there to a point where you could classify it as some form of identity that you could relate to from a Western perspective, I guess, then I would include it. But yeah, people of color and black lesbians particularly, the Harlem Renaissance was a big part of something that I really wanted to talk about because it's something that isn't really spoken about. Maybe the Harlem Renaissance is spoken about due to its creativity, but the queerness was just huge, men and women, trans people. It was amazing, like amazing. And that was something that I really wanted to hone in on. But once it got kind of turned into this book, I knew it was going to be a short book and I knew that it had to be fleeting. So yeah, it was tricky including the people that I included. But I guess the main thing was just to include as much as possible from many different countries, many different backgrounds, working class, middle class, just, and then along with the famous people that we know. So we know the Queen Anne's, we know the Virginia Woolf's.
Yeah.
They had to be in there as kind of pillars. And then the other people would be circling around that. But, you know, this book could be a billion pages long.
Yes.
But then also...
We're waiting for your billion page long sequel.
Shut up and take my money!
God, yeah, I wish. But then, yeah, you know, the evidence also is very difficult to find. So that would take a long time to write too. Yeah. But yeah, there's definitely more people to be included.
It's interesting because I think when we're doing queer history, we do have to, there's almost like a burden of proof issue, you know, and I don't know if I'm using that legalese correctly, but it's like you feel like you have to find enough evidence. You kind of have to justify calling someone queer or designating them as queer. And actually, I was looking through another book called Sapphistries, which I know you mention and used as a or inspired you. And I haven't read the whole thing, but I was just reading through the introduction again. And Layla Rupp, the author, talks about a few examples of non-Western sexuality or things that we would think were sexual that are not considered sexual in other societies, like women rubbing clitorises together or something, or kissing or holding hands, or all, you know, all of these clues that we think we pick up on as sexual. So I think there is, you do have to be really careful, you know, there, not that that's all, it's always an extreme example like that, but you can't use your definition of sex and sexuality to travel the world throughout time or space, right? You can't bank on that. That said, there's also, I think, another side of this that's kind of like common sense, you know? Like, there are, if a poet in the Middle Ages is talking about how he wants to kiss boys on the lips, like, there's something kind of gay going on. There's just, it's got to be something a little bit gay there, because he's not talking about kissing women on the lips, right? And there's a reason for that. So I don't know. There's a real tension there, because I agree with what you're saying, and I felt it too, that you have to be careful. But then you also just have to have some fucking common sense and be like, it could have been something else and it's not. So it's this. It's got to be this.
It always makes me laugh so much, though, how you really have to just get that amount of proof. Like, you actually need a woman to just have her fingers inside another woman and like a Polaroid of this from ancient Rome or whatever. Like,
and still they are roommates.
Like, and still it's like, well, you know, maybe she was looking for something. it's just like, oh my God, it just drives me mad and drives me so insane of that level of proof that you need. But then also I just also want to be like, fuck you. Like, I think they're gay and that's enough. You know, I'm a lesbian. I have the qualifications to decide who might be queer because I'm queer and they're queer. And so what? Like, why? If you've got a problem with that, then that says more about you than it does about me.
Yeah. Okay, I want to get back to that point in 1 second, but before we wrap this bit up, I also want to ask about labels and identities and using those words. And I mean, we already talked about this a little bit. Like, it's very refreshing to see you use all of these labels to describe women who are from periods where those labels would have meant nothing. But how did you work through that? Because there is a lot of blowback, I think, from both the public and from academics who are constantly berating people like us who are just trying to make this history more accessible, saying, you can't say that. That doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. That category. I mean, actually, I even have done it myself in some instances. Like, when the thing, you know, in England, that story that came out recently about the museum changing the pronouns of the Emperor Elagabalus. And so to me, I saw that and I was like, like, that just feels like we're projecting such a modern distinction onto an age that would have not had any, wouldn't have cared about that at all, and would have thought about it very differently. And also, I don't think we can speak for Elagabalus in that sense, to claim one way or the other. So I sometimes even find myself being the kind of like crony historian who's like, but wait. but I wonder how that felt for you writing this book, because you had to go through a lot of different time periods, a lot of different women, a lot of different geographies. Wow, I almost said markets. Oh my God. and I need to get out of my marketing job. But how was that for you? How do you grapple with that?
Oh, it was the hardest thing by 1,000,000%. It was so difficult. I struggle with it. Mm. Originally, the whole thing was they, them pronouns. Well, not all of them, but
interesting.
A lot of them were they, them pronouns. Mainly the ones that would dress in male clothing and then return and present as male, then return and present as female. And then we spoke with my editors and they were like, look, we need some clarity here. So there's a little revisionist kind of history bit at the beginning, where it explains that we're going to use the assigned pronouns because I just don't feel comfortable assigning pronouns to people when they can't speak them for themselves. But then the argument is, well, you feel comfortable assigning the labels. I don't know. It's labels in particular, I have a personal back and forth with myself, because as much as I love having a label because it means we exist, the fact that we have to have this label irritates me a bit.
But with
people in history, God, that was difficult. You know, it's like, who am I to say they're a lesbian? Who am I to say they're bisexual? Trans men and lesbians have such a shared history. It's unbelievable. And it's something that really needs to be highlighted. And I felt like that I did that. But a lot of trans people were not happy with the book. They thought I was being transphobic. They thought I was erasing trans history and trans people. But I really wasn't. I was just kind of using what was available to me, because trans was not an identity until, well, I mean, being trans and being queer has always been there. But being able to recognize that as a identity. And it's like, who am I to just... I had to be really careful about saying who my personal opinion on who these people were. And that's why I like to use the word queer, because it's such a nice word to use, because it's an umbrella term, isn't it? And we can kind of pack a lot of sexualities and identities into that. But yeah, with the main thing was with trans men and lesbians, that was the trickiest part, because people would present as male and then present as female. And you just don't know, because in that time, women would dress in men's clothes to feel safe.
Yeah.
Genuinely would do that to feel safe, not necessarily because they were trans. Whereas some women dressing in men's clothes probably did because they felt trans, or they felt like this is who they were and they were more comfortable as that. But we don't know that.
Right.
And I think if someone is in the community and someone is clearly coming from a good place, like you said before with this common sense thing and just... You know, someone is clearly coming from a good place. Someone is not out to be transphobic. You can clearly see that, you know. I am as inclusive as I try and be. And I think that really small part of lesbians, the TERF part, has just really just damaged this community so much. And then it's damaged a lot of lesbians and the representation that lesbians have. And we're all getting branded with this brush. So I just think if you see someone coming from a good place, you know, they are not trying to be... Like, why would I write a book about inclusivity and then exclude a really big part of the community? So you're always going to piss someone off, basically. You're always going to piss someone off.
Of course. We wouldn't expect anything less from our hyperactive, hyper-opinionated LGBTQ+ community.
Exactly. Yeah.
I remember running into this early on with Historical Homos, actually, where I was writing mostly on Instagram. And, you know, I like being flippant and using terms loosely and projecting modern things onto history. But a lot of several times people commented and are like, that's transphobic. That's your this or that. And I was like, am I really the person that you should be focusing on in this battle? Because I think the most important thing is showing that those concepts of gender fluidity and same-sex desire have existed irrespective of their label, right? Like, that's the work to be done. That's the exciting thing. That's the funny thing. That's the heartwarming thing. That's the life-changing thing. So I'm not surprised that that's happened to you. And at the same time, I think that the difficulty of these questions and the blurriness of the lines exists today just as it did back then, right? Like the fact that we didn't have clear-cut names to figure out in the 15th century whether Joan of Arc was non-binary or not, it, to me, is the same exact issue we have today with people not understanding what non-binary even means, right? Like these are complicated issues. They don't manifest themselves easily for anyone in any era. So that actually just occurred to me in listening to what you, in listening to your experience, that this shit is complicated. Like it's never not going to be complicated.
I know. And it's like, we are all trying our best, you know, vocabulary and terminology and things like this has moved rapidly in the last 20 years, especially with the internet and social media. And we're all learning, we're all trying, and but we're all also coming from a place where we want to highlight these people. So we're not erasing them. We're generating conversation, which is clear. That should be a good thing.
Yeah.
I think this, I really, really love this shared history of trans men and lesbians. The history of that, I really loved how it's shared and how it integrates with one another. And it's something that I'd really like to discuss more, but it's very difficult to get into that conversation without someone getting upset thinking that I'm trying to say they're all lesbians, or then, you know, you have that risk of butch lesbians, which is a historical part of queer history in itself, and that butch lesbians are so important to the growth of history and queer history and women. And you have that, like, it's difficult because then you worryingly are erasing them. So it's very difficult to navigate. And I really wish that we could be a bit forgiving and just a bit more tolerable and relaxed, really, because it's shit what's happening at the moment in our community. It's shit, but we're not against each other. We're all supportive of one another, and we shouldn't be fighting each other. We should be fighting the oppressor, and this is exactly what the oppressor wants. They always do this. They pit us against each other, and that's not what needs to happen.
And I think history is a really powerful way to explore that together and to bring people together over those shared stories of the different shades between femme, butch, trans men. Like all of these things, like I said, are complicated, but they've also been around for a long time. Like we have a lot of ancestors to look back to learn from and to experience together as a collective heritage. So actually this is an interesting segue, but I wanted to make sure I asked you, as a gay man, how do you feel writing a history of queer women when so much has been written about male homosexuality? Did you also read about male homosexuality as a part of your research, or did you kind of leave that by the wayside? What's different about the history of male homosexuality versus the history of female homosexuality?
I mean, I just wasn't interested in that. No offense. I just...
Absolutely don't take it.
I mean, look, in every minority, there's always a top... there's always a top one, isn't there? And like, gay men are the top of that, of our community. They always have been. I mean, I'm not saying that they haven't had it rough, because they've had it rough, but they are usually the ones that are written about. So I felt like I knew, because I love history anyway, so whenever I'd look for queer history, I'd find it in that. So I knew a lot about that already. It was something that I was interested in before I realized that, oh wow, queer women existed too. So I knew a lot about that. One thing that I would love to change about queer history, like gay males, bisexual men in history, is how sexualized it is, because it is all about just sex. And it was quite funny because with
who
women,
is penetrating whom?
Yeah, exactly. And it's so much more than that. But this was interesting, actually, in that with the women, with queer history with women, one massive thing for me was to include as much sex as possible, because men are sexualized in our community massively and women are not. So women are, lesbians in particular, we're always kind of the meek, you know, we're 10, like 55 year relationships, never cheat on anyone, stop having sex like 3 months in, but just like live a really happy life with cats. And yeah, maybe that is true. Maybe it's a bit true. But there's just never any sex. And, you know, women have a lot of sex with each other. And you don't see that in history. Yeah, and you do not see that in history. Straight women too. So that was something that I wanted to put back in. But with gay men, it's the opposite, isn't it? It's just so sexualized. Just like men on heat constantly.
Yeah. Well, and that's sort of the thing that defines, like, a man's sexual behavior is what defines him, right?
Yeah.
Throughout history, even today, if you have sex with men, you're gay.
Yeah.
Which is actually not true, right? Technically speaking. But that's the way that men are seen. Whereas women are very much the opposite, I think. Yeah. I think women who have sex with women are not assumed to be gay, right? It's a phase. It's experimentation. It's because women are fundamentally not expected to be sexual beings in the same
exactly,
way or to be motivated by their sexual behavior or desires or identities. So I think it's fascinating. The flip side of this, however, is something maybe it's a corollary to what you're saying, but I think the hypersexualization of men and queer men in history also obscures love between men and friendship and relationships. And that's as a you know, relatively young gay, as an aging twink, I am constantly wrestling with that.
It's really sad.
Yeah. We don't get, and actually it's something that I've envied in watching my lesbian friends and their relationships.
I bet, yeah.
and how women are able to connect with one another so deeply, and that is really missing from the gay community a lot of the time, and also from history, you know, because we don't see we see Oscar Wilde going to prison for indecent behavior. We don't actually talk
buggery.
About his relationship, right, for buggery.
Oh,
we don't
talk. It's just all these horrific words that are just all pointed at just sex. It's just, you've had sex, this is bad, go to prison or die, basically.
But we don't talk about him being in love with Bosie.
No, I know.
Right?
Like, which was
that
a really nice love affair.
That's what actually happened. That's what actually led to all of this. It wasn't his dad. Bosie's dad wasn't scared for his son because he was getting fucked up the ass. Like, that happened to a lot of British boys for a long time. He was scared because he was in love publicly with a man. That's the dangerous part. And then, of course, the other side of that is that it can be the burden of proof. You constantly have to bring the proof that it's more than friendship, right?
Two bros chilling in the hot tub 5 feet apart because they're not gay.
That it's that, like you said, I think you said in the book, you mentioned something about the phrase romantic friendship. And you're like, what the fuck is that?
I know.
What is romantic friendship? And it's just like that. I think that's like that's where it goes to a sort of place of erasure, right? Where we refuse to see love between women as something erotic
and passionate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, if you look at the Romans too, especially men there who had really loving, deep romantic relationships with each other. And again, that is just hypersexualized a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, but then I don't think it's my story to tell, which is another thing. I mean, if I started writing about a short history of queer men, I mean, who am I really to write about that? There's a lot more qualified people, I think, who would do a better job.
Well, perfect segue, because I wanted to ask you, do you have to be a queer woman to do the history of queer women, to write the history of queer women?
I don't think you necessarily have to be a woman. I think you should be queer, though. If you're going to write about queer history, I think it's important to be queer. I mean, I'm not going to stand around here and be like, you can't write about this because you're not queer. But I just think I wouldn't understand why someone who wasn't queer would want to write about it. I wouldn't really understand why they would want to do that. Mm. Because you, as a queer person, you have that lens and that intuition and the experience of being a queer person in this world. But then, you know, you look at history, which has been primarily written by white men, and look what they did. They haven't shown a good variation or example of history. So, I mean, that just proves the point, doesn't it? But I never want to be, I don't want to be exclusive and say things like that. I don't want to be like, you can't write about this. I just think, I just question, why would you? When someone who's queer could.
Sure.
Yeah.
Especially in today's world where we've got a lot of people. We have enough talent, you know?
Exactly,
I'm selfishly interested in this question because obviously I am a man, but I love writing about queer women because, like I said, I find women in history more interesting often than men and in daily life. But But I also am very aware that identifying with figures gives you unique insight into them.
Yeah.
I noticed this when I went to a talk done by a transgender historian on the Galli, who were the transgender priests of in ancient Rome, of a goddess named Cybele. And they did this talk, and all of these insights started bubbling to the top about what their lives must have been like, what it must have felt like to be simultaneously sort of revered and reviled. And listening to that, I was like, okay, no, it actually does matter who's saying this stuff about, you know, different groups in the past. So I don't know. I think there's a combination, because it's important for more people to think and write about queer history than not. So I actually think straight people should engage with this history, at least by consuming it, if not 100%, writing it.
Yeah.
But then there is something where it's like, we need to work together. Like, we need to, it takes a village to write queer history in a comprehensive way, because you do need that empathy, that insight that comes with self-identification.
Yeah. Consuming it 100%. I think queer history needs to be included in education and schools, but not necessarily as a subpart of just, we're going to study queer history now, but just as involved with history. So not even saying this is queer history, just being like, this is World War II, this is Anne Frank. Anne Frank wrote about how she really fancied her female friend. That's it, you know?
I love that story. I didn't know that story at all.
No one knows it.
That's so crazy. I know, and it. Okay, one last thing that I want to say before we move on, but I feel like there are figures like that in history, Anne Frank, who are kind of sacrosanct in a way, right? Like, we can't fuck with their reputation. We can't touch it. And often bringing queerness or sex, even just sex, like, and it feels like it tarnishes or threatens that place that they occupy in society. So I think that's like an interesting thing that I felt when I was reading that story of Anne Frank, because it's like, to me, that's fascinating. Like, that's such a humanizing, multi-dimensionalizing way of looking at this figure. But people actually want their saints to be their saints, you know? And it's dangerous to bring queerness into history in a way.
Yeah. But we're queer people, so for us to see something like that would be, as a child for me who loves history, would be mind-blowing. I'd be like, whoa, like, just a little insight into how she liked Peter, but she also liked her female friend. And then that would be it. It would have blew my mind. But we're queer people, so for us that is exciting and interesting. But as you said, for people like Anne Frank, actually, that was one of the stories that was, I went back and forth. My editors wanted it out. They just couldn't handle it. The fact that she's also 14. So there was a lot of different parts of trying to navigate that story without. But I was adamant, because it was one of the things that inspired the whole thing. Yeah. And I just thought, that needs to be in there. And I think by taking that out, you're insinuating that being queer is a bad thing. Because that's what her father did. Her father removed that from the diary because he was worried it was a bad thing, which is, that's his right, whatever. But we don't need to remove that now.
Right.
That doesn't need to be removed. We can all make our own opinions and whatever, and I'm frank. But we have the right to see that. And by removing it, if you remove that in schools, you're saying to the students that, you know, being queer is a bad thing and you cannot read about it. And this is such a vulnerable age, 14, you know, at school being 14, it's something you'd immediately relate to, wouldn't it? And it would have helped me individually and probably a lot of other people so much if I'd had read that.
100%. Like I said, I've been reading history my entire life. I did not come across these stories until I was in my early 20s. Like, that says something. That really says something, because it was not for lack of trying or lack of exploring. It's just not out there. Act 2, introducing the Lezzies, a new awards show for history's greatest queer women. Now, I think you've got definitely over 100 queer women in this text that you wrote. But I want to know who your top three are. I know it's wrong to hierarchicalize or whatever that goddamn word is, but we're living in the RuPaul's Drag Race era, and I do want to pageantify these women, as male gazy as that may be. Here are a few criteria for us to dole out our awards.
Good luck, and don't fuck it up.
Number one, queer, right? How gay are they? How horny are they? There are some people in this book who are absolute players, and I think that should be reflected in their gay report card, which is what this is. Second criterion, brilliant. How smart were they? How genius were they? Like you said, there are so many intelligent women that you cover in this book. Criterion number three, original. How creative were they? How different were they? How artsy were they? Four, badass. How wild were they? How cool were they? Were they really like at the forefront of some big new historical change or some, you know, underground society? Like I want to include that as well. And then five, sisterly. How supportive were they? How caring were they? Were they moving forward? Were they moving the community forward? That counts. That's got to count just as much as being a badass and being brilliant and original. So let's chat about, unless you've got your three ready off the bat, you're thinking about.
I could do three.
You got three. Perfect. Okay.
I could go three.
You got to start with number three. So okay. Who's in third place?
Okay. So German... I hope I pronounce this right. Katharina Hetzeldufer.
Hot.
Yeah, it's a hot name, isn't it? 1477. So this woman was the first person to be convicted and executed for a crime that had no name, which was penetrating another woman who they thought was her sister, by the way.
Okay, so she really wins on the sisterly criteria.
It's a really funny story, but not. But then she penetrated her sister, who was actually her girlfriend, with a massive red leather dildo.
Ooh, damn.
I know. And this is how like big? Huge. And this was like 1477. So, first woman to be convicted and executed of a crime that did not have a name. And
damn.
So having sex with a dildo, having sex with a strap-on.
Let me just also talk about leather dildos, okay? Because
always
I'm no stranger to a dildo, but leather, that texture scares me, the idea of that going inside. How really? Are we, does it, I mean, is it like, I'm imagining like stitches,
yeah, on so
it
am I.
To keep like it together football. Like yeah, it just doesn't I don't know, maybe I'm a sensitive Sally, but I don't want that. I want smoothness.
I didn't even think about that. I think for me it was the red that just caught my eye. So I've just been thinking on like how red it was. What kind of red was it? Was it a crimson or was it like a siren red?
I definitely pictured a like burnt sienna, like kind of orangey red. Maybe I'm picturing like, well, I'm picturing it worn with the time of history.
Yeah.
But the little lead ride, which little red riding rod. There we go. All right. No, wow. What was her name? Katharina Hetzeldufer?
Katharina Hetzeldufer. Yeah.
Hetzeldufer. All right. Sad. Wait. So do we know what happened to her?
Yeah, she drowned. They drowned her.
Oh, okay. So yeah, this is a tragic story.
I know.
Story.
It's like, it is a tragic story, but it weirdly makes me laugh. I think she would have liked that.
I think so too. I mean, there are worse ways to go out, you know?
I know. And I just love the intuition. I love that she made a red leather dildo and fucked her girlfriend who she pretended to be her sister. I just love that.
That's clever. That's clever also.
Yeah.
Although it sounds like that probably got her into more trouble.
She was her sister. And yeah, incest. But not incest.
Spoiler alert, it did not end well.
No. She's dead.
All right, Katharina. All right, who's in second place?
I think you have to say Anne Lister. Gentleman Jack. Yeah, you have to, don't you, really? Although she was a Tory, which annoys me.
Because she was like a rich bitch?
Yeah, she was a conservative and she was just a bit, you know, how Tories are. but I do love her because she... she's not the first woman, but we know this because of the writing. So in history, I guess she's the first woman to have to form this identity around her sexuality. She was aware of it and happy to an extent and followed it and decided to be it. And yeah. I liked how she would chat women up by asking if they liked Byron just to see their reaction. And that would be her way of figuring out if someone was gay, which is something that we do to this day. Maybe not so much now we have the internet, but pre-internet, there was always, how do you figure out if someone's a lesbian? You know, short fingernails.
Yeah.
What films do they like? Do you like Ellen? Do you listen to the Indigo Girls? Just things like that.
Absolutely.
So I like that. And she would keep pubic hair from people that she'd slept with.
Oh, 100%. Nice. Very kind of Angelina Jolie, right. Billy Bob Thornton
vibes. Yeah, yeah.
I also love that she left this massive coded diary behind. If memory serves, she used some like ancient Greek code for it, right? So she wrote in Greek letters, which that just tickles me in a way because I studied classics. And but also the sort of self-assured ego that it requires to leave such extensive diaries behind that, by the way, are decipherable. Like, you're writing in a code, but you know that someone's going to read it eventually. Or you're kind of trying to get someone to read it. So I think she's kind of brilliant. First of all, she's brilliant just as from an intelligence perspective. We know that she was extremely educated and all of that. But I think she's just got this kind of like badass, like, I fucking rock, dude. And everyone's going to know it one day or another. She has a lot of big lesbian energy, modern lesbian energy.
She does. Yeah.
Editor's note. The cat agrees.
So, you know, the whole nickname, having a nickname, this like fuckboy attitude that a lot of lesbians have these days, or just wearing all black, just that quintessential lesbian player, you know, it was just, she kind of embodied that. And I guess it was very sexual as well, which I was saying before, when women don't have sex, apparently, but she had a lot of sex and she loved it.
Right.
You know, she even got chlamydia once because of having too much sex. I know.
Wow. You got to work hard for that for 19th century lesbians.
Although she did get it. She got it off her girlfriend's husband. Her girlfriend was married.
Oh, her girlfriend got it from her husband.
So the man was sleeping. Yeah, so the man was sleeping about. Give it to his wife. She gave it to him.
Got it. Okay. All right. Well, that's still kind of a trophy for Anne.
I agree.
Go, Anne.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's our first place winner?
I think maybe Lorraine Hansberry. I think for me, she was the first black playwright, the first with her play A Raisin in the Sun. It was the first black play on Broadway written by a black man with a black all-star cast. Written by a black lesbian woman. So
yes,
and a black woman. Yeah, but you know, that is just so important. And when you get a lot of people these days who go, why do you have to say she's black? Like, why is that? Why does that matter? And it's like, it does matter. Of course it matters. Because in that time when that was just near enough impossible, and she's a lesbian, it's just like, this woman is amazing. But one thing was, at the time, there was this magazine called The Ladder, which was written by this like group of lesbians that got together and just distributed this magazine as one of the first lesbian magazines in the US. And Lorraine Hansberry had stumbled upon it. I don't know how she got hold of it, but she got hold of it. She was married to a man at the time. And she was so happy that this paper, this newspaper existed, and that people like her existed. They were white, but, you know, a lesbian culture existed, that she wrote to them several times. And one of the things she said was, I'm glad as heck that you exist. And it was that phrase that really stuck with me. And it was the title of my book for a really long time, but we had to change it.
That's cool.
Yeah, but that phrase just really stuck with me, because I think I felt like that looking at people through history. Like, I'm really glad these people exist, because without them, what would we be now? And her excitement of seeing someone at the same time in the same country doing what she did, it's exciting. And I remember being young, and you know, when you find another lesbian or another queer person, it's exciting, isn't it? These people exist, and you're like, oh, it's not just me. So yeah, I'd say Lorraine Hansberry would be number one.
I love, and I love that she's number one because she got that line. Like, there's not, sometimes you just need a good line, right?
Yeah, man.
Like,
yeah.
I'm glad as heck that you exist. The thing that I was thinking about Lorraine Hansberry when I was reading your book, and which I didn't know about her, is sort of the gradual coming to terms with her sexuality that she experienced. It sounds like in part through writing to this publication,
yeah.
Right? And because she was married to a man who, was he gay too?
No,
was
no, it? No, no.
No. So no. She was married to a man. So she sort of did the expected thing, right? Like a lot of people did. I just watched Maestro about Leonard Bernstein,
yeah.
Or Stein. And, you know, he was obviously fully gay, but he got married because that was what you did. And that's how you had a family, yeah. And presented as presentable.
And it means nothing. Because people always use that as an argument, don't they? They're like, well, they were married. And you're like, so? Everyone was married. Like,
I know.
Doesn't mean they're not queer.
My other favorite is, how can he be gay? He has children. One that I often actually heard from my own mother growing up. I was like, it's really easy to have sex with anyone. Really easy. That's like straight people trying to hold on to the things that define them. But... yeah, no, I thought it was really beautiful, actually. And of course, it's unbelievably tragic that she died at such a young age. I think about that a lot. And it's just so scary to know that you could get something as serious as pancreatic cancer at that age. But she, before she died, she came to terms with this identity and she really worked through it and wrote through it, it felt like, right?
Yeah.
I think that's such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, she really embraced the culture as well by the end of it. She'd go to a lot of lesbian parties at the time in Greenwich.
Yes.
Patricia Highsmith, people like that were there. Again, I remember reading a lot of her writing and at the time, her diaries, and it was very white. And she'd often be the only black lesbian in the room.
Yeah.
But yeah, she did write a lot about it and a lot about that time and did seem to work her way through it via writing, which is a really nice way to look at it.
It's beautiful. Okay. Yeah. Well, there you have it. The top, the Lezzies, the inaugural Lezzies celebration. It's going to be a big thing. It's going to be big. Before we go, we like to always close with a straight apology.
It's a straight apology.
So this week, I thought we would demand an apology from one of the heterosexuals, one of the villainous heterosexuals that features in your book, Kirsty. And that is the Member of Parliament, Noel Pemberton Billing. So tell us about Noel. He was from the early 20th century. He wrote something called The Cult of the Clitoris, which is actually the coolest thing about him.
I know.
But he also tried to character assassinate a lot of lesbians publicly, yeah, and
just women.
Make it illegal.
So in 1918, so just the end of the First World War, at the time, there was the British MPs were trying to make being a lesbian illegal. So it was being a homosexual man was illegal. That was illegal. But women didn't, there was nothing there. There was no law against it. So they came up with this idea. They were like, maybe we should make it illegal. But the whole conversation was, they were either really embarrassed to talk about it or just mortified that they had to talk about it. And they just went back and forth for ages talking about how to make this illegal. And in the end, they just decided not to do anything because they thought if they made it illegal, then women would know about it and it would make them do it even more. So they thought they basically thought they invented lesbianism. And then they were like, no, we can't let them know. So
guys, this really should be illegal, but they have never thought about this before.
So
they have
we can't
never thought
tell
it.
Them. And Noel Pemberton Billing.
So was, insane.
I know, but it's like that would happen today probably too. But sure. So he wasn't involved in that, but he was around those sort of people. And he just hated everyone that wasn't a white man with money. And so this was the end of the war, you know, people were paranoid, people were freaking out. I don't think it was the end of the war yet. I think it was just coming to an end. But he had this mate called Harold Sherwood Spencer, who was dismissed from the army for being really paranoid. He wasn't very well,
sure.
But they were mates. And Harold had somehow come across this woman called Maud Allen, who was a dancer, a Canadian dancer. And he decided that she was a lesbian and she was turning other women into lesbians. So he had this whole thing.
That's often how it works.
And she was a lesbian. And she was probably turning women into lesbians. So this guy, Harold, went to Noel and he was like, so, you know, there's this woman in London in the Palace Theatre, really successful show. You know, there's loads of women there every night. There was a lot of suffragettes that would actually go and see her every night, which is code for lesbians. And he then started going on about how there was a black book that the Germans had and it was full of sexual perverts. So thousands and thousands of sexual perverts. Now, I think when he says sexual perverts, he means queer people. I don't think he means, you know, like flashers with an anorak. He was flashy in the street. I think his sexual perverts was queer people. So he was adamant that Maud Allan was in this book and all these other people were. So he told Noel Pemberton Billing about it. And then Noel Pemberton Billing was like, oh, I'm going to the government because there's this black book full of, you know, gay people. I'm going to go and tell the government. They were like, whatever, like we have more things to do. The country's broke. We've got no money or food. Everything's destroyed. Like, go away.
But so the lesbians, livid. They're dancing. Yeah.
And he's livid. So he's like, there's this lesbian going around turning people into lesbians. There's a black book full of gay people. You need to listen to me. So he wrote this article called The Cult of the Clitoris, which just sounds like a porno for lesbians.
I mean, it sounds like a book I really need to read.
I know, me too. But it wasn't a nice book or an article. Yeah. It was just about how there were lots of queer people. Oscar Wilde was in there. Just, you know, the fun, cool people in London were in a black book that the Germans were going to blackmail. So this was his whole thing. So he wrote this thing and the word clitoris got people's attention because you know what British people are like. They see that word clitoris in a newspaper. They're like, oh my gosh. So that was shocking. So then the government did listen. Then Maud Allan was like, whoa, why are you going around telling everyone that I'm trying to seduce all the women in London? I'm going to sue you for libel. So she sued him. And as you'd expect, he represented himself because, you know, that's what Ted Bundy does. And that's what he did. But then he also randomly hired, he was married, but he was having an affair with this woman called Eileen. And he just like randomly had Eileen as his witness. So Eileen would come into the court and just be like, he's telling the truth. I've seen this book. And actually she was looking at the judge and she was like, you're in the book. So the judge was like, what?
Oh, it's giving very like McCarthy vibes.
Isn't it? So the judge was like, what? I'm in this book. Okay. And then she's... And then they found out that Maud's brother was a serial killer. So he was a serial killer. Yeah, I know. So he was a serial killer in San Francisco. And because her brother was a serial killer, you know, obviously she was also a bad person.
A lesbian.
Yeah. A lesbian, a serial killer. So that with the judge being in the book, the serial killer brother, Noel Pemberton Billing was acquitted. They were like, you're fine. Everything you're saying is true. The lesbian is weird. Get rid of her. So Maud Allan was just like, fuck this, I'm leaving the UK and I'm going to go to the US. And she just brought her girlfriend and went to the US and lived in the US. Meanwhile, okay, Eileen, the lover, got done for bigamy like 2 months later and then finally admitted that she'd made the whole thing up and that actually there was no book. Maud Allan wasn't trying to like fuck other lesbians or make everyone into a lesbian and that Harold and Noel had just made the whole thing up.
Wow. Okay, It sounds like we don't need to apologize just for Noel Pemberton Billing, but we need to reach out to Eileen's team and ask for a formal apology. Or unless she apologized in her bigamy case. She just admitted it.
The whole story just made me laugh so much because it's just so ridiculous and pointless and a waste of everyone's time. And that's just the majority of what these persecutions were for queer people. It was just a waste of time and money and bullshit that you just have to put up with. These men just being paranoid.
Just Maud's luck also to get an obviously gay judge who was like, holy shit, they know.
I know.
Like,
I know.
one person who is like, what, just stooping some random guy says, you're gay too. You're in the book. And then he like completely crumbles.
How do they know?
Good God. All right. Well, I mean, like I said, we'll reach out to their team to demand an apology because we're certainly not fucking apologizing for them. But until then, listeners, please remember, straight people have always been and will always be the most dangerous people you know. All right, Kirsty, thank you so, so much for joining us. This was such a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Thank you very much for having me on.
And everybody, go read Kirsty's lovely book, A Short History of Queer Women. It's an easy read. It's a funny read. It'll titillate you, maybe make you a little horny, and you'll learn something.
Hope so.
Thanks, Kirsty.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us this week. If you like what you hear, give us a little 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. Yeah, that's right. Go to the app, open it just at the top of the page, just like that. Mommy likes when you listen. Oh, and follow us at historical.homos on Instagram and at historicalhomos on TikTok. See you next week. Love you.